Welcome back to Between the Tackles. Week 5 action is behind us. We are getting ready for week 6. But before I get ahead of myself, I am your host with the most. I am Hogan, here finally back from his little sabbatical, his little celebration, dancing around the town because he's finally got some picks right. Burgess, how are we doing, buddy?
I'm pumped to be back. Fortunately, just getting over a nice fun illness where I spent the entire weekend on the couch. So that wasn't fun. You probably hear my voice here a little raspy, but not going to keep me away from talking football with you guys here today. So let's go.
That's right. I'd say we'd love to have you back, but I'd be lying. I can't speak for our third person here. Manish, the man with the plan. How are we doing today?
I'm doing great. My Phillies at this recording are 3 outs away from being eliminated in the first round. So, you know, doing a lot better than the Phillies, that's for sure.
Well, I guess they're just taking a page out of the Eagles playbook at this point. So sorry, didn't mean to push it there, but I just had to throw it up for you guys. But yeah, no, we had an exciting week of football as always. We're going to get to all of the look behinds at what happened, what transpired this past weekend. And then we're going to obviously take a look ahead as to the biggest games that are on the schedule for week 6. But before we get ahead of ourselves here, I want to throw the microphone to Manish, who has a little bit of a tiff with our NFL Players Association and some breaking news that came out recently about reporters and what they're able to do with interviews in the locker room. Manish, you want to take it away?
Sure. Last week, the NFL Players Association released a statement saying that they would like reporters not to cover teams in locker rooms, so not to conduct interviews inside the locker room. Instead, there'll be a designated area at the facility where players and reporters can meet up to talk. It's actually very similar to how European soccer conducts its interviews. This isn't a new rule that the NFLPA is instituting. They don't have that power. The NFL does. The NFL is resisting that. Personally, I think that's just because it'll be a bargaining chip when the next collective bargaining agreement comes up, and then maybe reporters will be effectively banned from the locker room. But I just want to explain to fans why it's important that reporters are in the locker room. I think there's a notion that reporters don't need to be in the locker room. What's the advantage of that? What do I, as a consumer, a fan, what do I get out of it? How do I benefit? What I would say is that typically, locker rooms are open for about 45 minutes, 4 times a week, excluding game day, which they're obviously at the stadium, on that day. But during the week, it's 4 times a week for 45 minutes. These players are in the facility for, upwards of 15, 16 hours, depending on the player, but they're there for a big chunk of time, 4 times a week. So this is a very small amount of time that the reporters are allowed in the locker room. And, I've always believed and said to players that, yeah, it's your workplace for the majority of the day, but for like 5% of the day, it's also my workplace. And there's been a healthy respect for at least in my interactions and the players I've dealt with. Now that the NFL Players Association ostensibly says that it's an invasion of privacy. Some guys, as you guys are fully aware, when you see an interview on TV, maybe there's a guy who's partially naked or maybe even fully naked in the background, particularly after games. So that is the contention from the league, the Players Association, the union, I should say. I will say in my 15 years covering the NFL, I think that's largely overblown, but guys don't really care if they get part of their body shot in the background of an interview, once every 7 years or 8 years or how often it is. And I will also say that the reporters that I have dealt with and the colleagues and competitors have always respected a player's privacy in the locker room. If you're changing after you take a shower after practice, you're not going to see a reporter, or at least I haven't seen a reporter wait for a player in front of their locker. There's usually enough space where you give them an opportunity to put their shorts on. Some guys, I remember Nick Mangold would not conduct an interview unless he had his shirt on. I mean, that's kind of a minority because most guys are in great shape. They don't really care if their shirts are off. And I think if you talk to any man, who's a pro athlete, conducting an interview without your shirt on is not a big deal. It's never been a big deal in my interactions with players. But the larger point is, here's why it's important. reporters can establish relationships with players, and there's a trust that is developed that helps the reader, the fan, really get the story of what's going on behind the scenes. You know, there's a content providers that each organization has. They work for the team. You know, ironically, for the Patriots, one of those content providers was a team employee, Evan, I think it's Lazar or Lazar, on his Patriots in-house podcast last week said that the players were going to have a mutiny if they didn't make a quarterback change, which was, you know, prophetic because, you know, a few days later, the Patriots did make a quarterback change. But the larger point here is that if you want to find out what's actually happening with the team behind closed doors, if you want a reporter to be somebody who gives you good information and pull back the curtain, then those interactions that they have with players one-on-one in a locker room setting are invaluable, because when you take them out of a locker room setting and you put them in a room, I guarantee there'll be a public relations official standing right next to the player and the interviewer. And so it's not really a private conversation. And again, my conversations I've had with players, in 90% of it was about establishing a rapport and a trust level so they can tell me how they actually feel instead of giving me a sanitized version. Now, if you're a fan and you want the PR, the spin, everything's great all the time, then sure, you don't care about that access. But if you actually want to know, hey, why is Drake May not starting? What's really happening, between player A and player B? Why is player A benched? What happened on this particular play in a game? Whose responsibility was it? Whose fault was it? You don't get that kind of information unless you have an actual relationship with the players. And, you know, at least speaking on my behalf, since I covered the league, I've always been older than, 90% of the players. I mean, now I'm older than basically 100% of the players. But when I started my career, I was older than most of these guys. And I think there's a healthy respect between reporters and the mature players. I mean, there's some guys coming right out of college, probably have a little bit more growing up to do. But by and large, having that access, there is a trickle-down effect where the reader, the fan, does benefit. And I don't think people quite understand that. A lot of them think, the media is a nuisance, and they're out to get players, they're out to get teams, pretend that things are going poorly. When things are going poorly, don't act like everything is great, because that's the job of the content provider who's employed by the team. And reporters are not team employees. They're supposed to be independent, objective, and ultimately their driving force is to provide the readership, the listenership, the viewership with what's really going on. The only way you can do that is to develop a relationship with people in the building, in the organization, players included.
I'll just say this, and as a fan of the league, you hear all the talk radio talk about everything, and you hear the guys that are in the room and such. Like, even if you're not getting direct quotes from these players, having that access into the room, you can get the stories, necessarily quoted and everything.
Right.
And for me, as a fan, I love ingesting that type of content. Like, it's what keeps me involved in the league, when games aren't being played and such. So for me, I totally agree with where you're coming from on this.
And for me, I just want to say, Manish, that you don't look any older than Drake May. So give yourself some more credit there, okay? I got
Drake
you covered.
I could easily be Drake May's father.
Oh, stop it. You look amazing. I don't want to hear it. But no, it'll be interesting to see going forward what happens, obviously, between this issue with, obviously, the reporters and the media going toe-to-toe with the NFLPA at this point. It'll be interesting to see, too, if the NFL actually decides to step in and commit to one side or what have you. So just wait and see, and we'll hopefully get some answers on that sooner than later. But let's move on to our next subject here, where we are obviously a pro-Patriots podcast. And boy, oh boy, I don't know if you can be pro-Patriots anything with the way that they've been playing lately. Burgess, I know you were laid up this weekend on the couch, so you didn't get to see a whole lot of the game. That's probably for your benefit at this point, because gosh darn, do they suck. They are absolutely terrible. They dropped another doozy at home to the hapless Miami Dolphins, 15-10. Tyler Huntley was the best quarterback on the field. it's gotten to go off of what Manish you were talking about is the mutiny in the locker room there apparently decided that it was time for Drake May to start, and going forward May is going to be the starter this week against Houston. But before we get to that point, either one of you, I'll throw it to one of you, just give me your thoughts on the Patriots at this point. Burgess, let me know what's up. Are we just wasting our time watching the Patriots?
I saw a good chunk of the game. I was laid up, but I saw a good chunk of this game, and it's probably what contributed to me being so sick this weekend and still being sick on Sunday and early Monday morning from having to ingest this travesty of a product. But, you know, they scored the early touchdown. I think it was in the second quarter. They were winning majority of this game, like majority of the game they were up, and it just seemed like one more score again. It was like, it kind of felt like Seattle, where they needed one more score, where they needed to win. At least in the Seattle game, they were able to put some points on the board. But for me in this game, it's just like, dude, you put up 10 points against this Miami team. Your defense only gave up 15. And I don't care who the other quarterback is. They still have a ton of talent on that, you know, with the receiving core. I know Devon Achane got banged up with a concussion early in this game, but Mostert was having some success running the ball, and so was Jalen Wright. To me, it's just like you watch Jacoby Brissett and that offense operate, and it's, I don't want to say it's like watching Mac Jones back there, because like Jacoby Brissett, yeah, he's not making any real plays, but he's being careful with the ball. He's not turning it over. You know, it's a very safe operation with what we've seen out of the Patriots offense through the first, you know, quarter of the season. But it's now at the point where it's just unwatchable. And it feels like, you mentioned Drake May, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but like, I don't put this all on Jacoby Brissett. And I know there's a lot of fans out there that are just, we're all the first quarter of the season, we're just, Kobe sucks, it's all him. It's like, no, dude, like, you see how often that dude was just getting absolutely planted in the backfield? Like, he just seemed like every play he was getting hit, and he was getting up gingerly and walking, you know, slowly back to the huddle. And, you know, it's just, the whole offense is just a mess. I think the play calling's been a mess. Ramondre Stevenson, I know he had a nice touchdown run in this game, but, you know, going into this, I'm a huge fan of him, but his fumbles have been an absolute problem, you know, fumbling in every game, I think, except for this last one against Miami. So they just have a multitude of problems. The receivers aren't getting separation. Now, that could be a product of the quarterback too, right? The quarterback not seeing the open guy. You know, I have a hard time to believe that these receivers are just that bad, that they're just never getting open against any defense. I have a real hard time believing that. I mean, we'll see if it looks any different, you know, going forward. But it's the same as last year. The offense is just as dysfunctional as it was last year. And you can't blame the coaching this year, really. You can't really blame the quarterback this year. It's all different pieces, and it looks essentially the same. So for me, I'm happy that, you know, we might see a different product going forward.
Yeah, I think one thing that we look back on this game that really stuck out to me was they reported after the game that the Patriots actually set a franchise record for most yards per rush in this game, and they still found a way to lose the game. I think they averaged, it was like 7.9 or 8 yards per rush between Stevenson and Gibson, and they still found a way to lose it. And the big thing that fascinates me is a lot of people came out. I watched fifth quarter with obviously the homers with Christian Fourier and Zolak there screaming how this was the worst post-Brady loss they've ever seen. And I'm sitting there going, well, if you go back to last year, I remember 3 games in a row that the offense couldn't score more than 7 points, and we lost all 3 of those games. And the defense, you know, the Colts game over in Germany, the Giants game, and there was another one there. I think they, like, what was it? The Chargers game. They lost the Chargers. So they lost to the Chargers last year, 6-0. And we're sitting here going, this is the worst game you've seen post-Brady. Stop it. Stop it. It's a bad game. It's very terrible. Not good product on the field. I agree with you, but it's very... If we're not losing 6-0 to the Chargers, I'm saying that's probably a better product on the field. What do you got?
This is what we expected this year.
Exactly.
You know, we were given, and I took the cheese after the Bengals game. I was sitting here with Manish saying they could be 4-0 after September. You know, San Francisco's got injuries and the Jets are the Jets, blah, blah, blah. I took the cheese. I was very, very wrong. Let's be real. Yeah. But like, this is what we expected. We expected them to suck like this. So exactly. Nobody should be surprised.
And that's a big thing. I think a lot of Patriots fans, as delusional as they get to be sometimes, especially with the last 20 plus years of success that this team's put on the field, you can't remember. You have to, at the end of the day, you have to remember that this is not all rings and daisies and flowers across the board when you have a team like the New England Patriots where they are in a complete and full rebuild at this point. It is not, they were not going to be contending for a playoff spot. This was already, like you said a million times on this podcast, you've punted on the year. The Patriots have punted on this year clearly after week one. I'm still aggravated they won week one because you know what? That might end up costing them in the draft. And yeah, I'm going to keep bringing that up because yeah, I will keep saying that because honestly, they need the draft capital at this point with the way this team is built. Before we move on with this suck fest, Manish, you got any thoughts on the Patriots at this point?
Well, yeah, I mean, they have to be more than one dimensional. You know, the run game for the most part has been really good this season. You know, you mentioned the I think it was like 140 some odd yards between the two running backs. I mean, that's awesome, but your quarterback just can't throw for $150, $100. Oh, it was like 100 to 150 every week. That can't happen. And what was interesting about this game is that the defense played so well, except when it mattered the most. They, you know, giving up three field goals for, you know, the majority of the game is great, but then you can't give up a back-breaking 15-play touchdown drive late in the fourth quarter to lose. So for all the good they did in the first three and a half quarters, they kind of gave it back at the end. And they have been a pretty disciplined team, but it was uncharacteristic for them to have 12 penalties. They had over 100 yards in penalties. So I mean, that was uncharacteristic. So all that adds up to is a loss to a very bad team. You know, I know we're going to talk about Drake May in a little bit. And I think when you look at this chapter, you know, it is, you know, what we kind of thought it would be from an offensive standpoint with Brissett. Maybe that can change with Drake May. I think it will change a little bit with Drake May. If you're looking for a silver lining, the defense, you know, by and large, has been a really good unit. And trust me, I've covered many teams where the offense just isn't nearly good enough. And for as good as the defense is, you know, at some point they're going to break within the course of a game. And I think that's what you saw last week.
My thing is the defense, even last year, it was kind of the same thing where it was like they'd be so shut down the whole time. And then right when you need that one stop, they crack. It was always in the most inopportune time that the defense would crack. And that's always been, over the last couple of years, that's been my only beef with the defense. Is they've been great the whole time. And no, it's not their fault that they cracked at that moment and that the offense couldn't score the points. But it's like, every time, that inopportune moment was when they decided that they were just going to be like, we're going to let them through.
I think
that was the most frustrating part about it.
Yeah.
They were on the field for a lot. They were, sure. They got beat in time of possession by 9 minutes. And I think the Dolphins ran like 20 more plays than they did. So there's only so much a defense can do. I'm not making an excuse for the defense, but I'm just trying to lay out the reality is that if you're on the field for that long, and I still don't understand how they were on the field for that long, because Miami wasn't really good on third down. So somehow they found themselves in a severe time of possession deficit. I mean, I think part of that is the offense wasn't particularly good. Their own offense wasn't particularly good. But I mean, I like the defense. I mean, honestly, I think, like, as you touched on, Birch, very similar to last year, that you kind of knew that they weren't going to get blown out a lot because their defense would keep them in games. But I'll be interested to see how things change on the offensive side with Drake May, because you're going to see a little bit of play alteration just because of his athleticism, you know, compared to Brissett. I don't think if Drake May were playing on Sunday that he would have been hit 9 times like Brissett was. So that's an added dimension that we can get into a little bit that I think will certainly benefit the offense moving forward.
One thing I think a lot of people are forgetting about too is at the end there, the Patriots had every chance to win this game as well, with that Jalen Polk touchdown being called back due to the rule, which honestly, I didn't know about the rule, but if you actually look at the rule, it was the correct call. See? Not being biased, no homerism this time with the whole Chiefs thing. I admit it was not a touchdown. I mean, granted, I think that rule sucks now because of what happened, but the rule is the rule, and definitely it was unfortunate to see that end up that way. But let's move on from the suck fest that we all know and love as the New England Patriots, and let's move on to another wonderful subject, being one of the Patriots players, Jabril Peppers, got arrested before the game. Burgess, tell me what the heck happened with this whole situation.
You know, I saw the notification come across my screen, and I'm just like, dude, like, I love Jabril Peppers as a player. Okay. And, you know, he is was a captain of the defense. And, you know, you get a report that he's been arrested. I think it was for assault, battery, strangulation, I believe, was involved in that, you know, in regards to a domestic incident with his girlfriend. And it's like, you know, this is a guy who has been well spoken with the Patriots. You know, he's been a vocal leader of this defense. I think he was a captain. I don't know if he was last year. If he was, it was might have been mid-season where he kind of got elevated again. But, like, he was a captain this year. And I love the way the guy plays. And for whatever reason, you're hearing all this with these athletes, and they just make these dumb decisions to just throw everything away. And now he's on the commissioner's exempt list. Not allowed to be in the facility, not allowed to practice, not allowed to do anything like that. And to be honest with you, he shouldn't. If what the allegations are against him are true, he's probably not going to play again. So, you know, the NFL, obviously going back a decade, takes these domestic violence things, or tries to take them seriously, you know, based on the bad PR they got a decade ago with the whole Ray Rice incident and everything like that, with how they botched the handling of that entire thing. So it's too bad to see something like this happen, but some of these athletes just can't get out of their own way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's really an unfortunate, you know, situation. And obviously, we're very invested in it being Patriots fans. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, regardless of who you root for, just this type of behavior is completely unacceptable. And especially a big thing that I'm curious to see is how the NFL handles this whole situation, as opposed to, you know, the Rashee Rice incident with the whole car thing this off season and whatnot. But it seems like, we were talking pre-recording, just like you said, these athletes can't get out of their own way when it comes to just boneheaded decisions that just cost them potentially their future, their football future, their rest of their lives, depending on the, you know, ramifications of what they're absolutely doing. I don't need to talk about the situation, but Henry Ruggs, that's obviously mm-hmm. one of the worst situations we've seen off the field. So hopefully people need to learn from their mistakes, but at the same time, just don't make mistakes in the first place. Or you've given millions of dollars, you know, don't be dumb. It's not hard. I mean, I try my best not to be dumb, but I mean, I also went 0-3 in my picks this past week. So I'm not a good judgment of character at this point with the teams that I pick, but let's move on. Manish, I want to talk a little bit about Josh Allen this weekend. I don't know if you caught the game. Obviously, it was one of the big games where the Houston Texans were playing, you know, the Bills, and the big revenge game for Stephon Diggs and how bad he wanted this, blah, blah, blah. But the real big thing that I think people took away from this game was the hit that Josh Allen took, where his head bounced off that turf about a foot in the air after he got I don't think he got sacked. I think he just got hit and it looked like he was unconscious, and they took him off the sidelines. It was like a couple plays later, he was back in the game. Are the Buffalo Bills going to be hearing from anybody about their concussion protocols at this point?
No, I don't think so, because he was cleared by an independent neurologist. And I think what makes it even clearer that he passed that, that series of tests is that he's not in the protocol this week. If he were in the protocol this week, that would obviously raise eyebrows and a whole lot of questions, but he's not even in the protocol. So he did in fact clear, you know, the test that he needed to clear. It just, the optics were so bad because of how, as you said, how bad the hit looked. And I think there's a shot of him on the sideline with his hands on his head. And it's clearly a point of emphasis in the league, but if an independent, position clears him and he subsequently is not in the protocol in the run-up to the following game, then he clearly didn't have a concussion. It seems kind of odd based on what we saw, but there's no incentive for an independent neurologist to clear any player, and that's the whole reason that they're there. It's so there's no team bias. And again, it didn't look like he would be cleared. It was kind of surprising, you know, given some of the other things we've seen with guys getting hit and not coming back to games after going through the protocol. But everyone's different. You know, everyone's body reacts differently to impact. And clearly, Josh Allen, sufficiently proved to the independent neurologist that he was ready to go back in. And again, because he's not in the protocol this week, I think that wouldn't raise any red flags from the league in terms of any kind of sketchy behavior by any sideline position.
I looking at that hit, he was out cold. Like, you look at him and you could see almost like him laying there, and you could see him kind of like shaking a little bit. Like, he looked like he was out cold. And for me, the sketchy part of this isn't so much against the Buffalo Bills, as much as I want to just come in here and just razz the crap out of them. I think this falls more on the league's protocol in general. And the reason I say that is because if you listen to Josh Allen talk after this game, he made no mention of the fact that he was evaluated for a head injury. He said something along the lines that he rolled his ankle, and that's why he came out for a few plays. And then there was an image that I think CBS showed on the broadcast, where a Bills trainer is trying to hand them a smelling salt. And we all know what smelling salts do. They kind of mask those symptoms. They wake you up. They get you going. And, you know, that tells me that they knew there was something going on there with his head. And then, of course, Josh Allen, you know, I watched a couple of YouTube clips on this, because obviously I was like, I'm zeroed in on this because it's the Buffalo Bills, right? But I was watching some of his press conferences, and he had people pointing out, like, when Josh Allen was answering the question about his head, gave a lot of indications that he was kind of, I don't want to say being untruthful, but like, he wasn't making eye contact with the people that he was talking to. He was kind of fidgety and looking around, and he's like, yeah, I rolled up on my ankle. That's why I came out for a few plays. I don't know if I don't see anything from McDermott or anything like that about them actually acknowledging any kind of head issue. You could see the reactions from some of the linemen that were on the field, where he kind of mouthed like, oh, F, like, you know, you could see it where he was like all that. And you could tell when they were looking at him on the field, they weren't looking at his ankle. They were looking at his head, because his head walloped off that turf. I don't know how anybody wouldn't suffer a concussion from hitting their head so hard off the turf like that. Cause if you watch it in real time, it's like, bam. So for me, it seems like there was something that went on. I don't want to blame the team, because it is an independent neurologist that works for the league that is supposed to spot this stuff and supposed to evaluate and do all that. And where you're not seeing anything even from the player to acknowledge that he cleared the protocol, to me, something seems fishy.
Well, there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. Our conspiracy theorists are out and about. Burgess, go after Buffalo. I want to see it. I want to see Josh Allen sit for multiple weeks. Screw the Bills at this point. I mean, they're running away with the AFC East the way it is. So
I'm just glad he's, I'll be honest with you, I'm glad he's okay. Because anytime somebody wops their head like that, we've seen so many of these concussions this year. With Tua in the division is the prime example, where you guys got to think about the rest of their lives. They're not even just talking about football at this point. Like those head injuries, you cannot mess around with those. You just can't.
Agreed for sure. And let's use this as a segue, where the Buffalo Bills' next opponent is going to be the New York Jets. And the New York Jets don't have a certain coach prowling around on their sidelines anymore. Manish, give me the lowdown. What happened to Robert Saleh? How come he's unemployed?
Yeah, you know, it's surprising, because in the past, when people have said, well, you know, this coach should be fired, whether it was Saleh or Todd Bowles before him, I always said, you know, if Woody Johnson, the owner, doesn't fire coaches in season. It's just not what he does. He's owned a team for a quarter century and had never done it prior to a few days ago when he fired Saleh. I was surprised. You know, the timing of it really makes no sense. If you wanted to move on from Saleh, it would have been understandable, just given the lack of results in his first several seasons as the head coach. You would have done it in the offseason. You would have done it in January, you know, on Black Monday, thereby giving you an opportunity to go after Mike Vrabel or Bill Belichick or whoever you wanted during the offseason hiring cycle. So to do it 5 games into a season, by the way, in which they're 2-3, it's not a lost season. And Hogan, you had mentioned that the Bills are running away. The Bills are 3-2. So whoever wins that game on Monday night is going to be in first place, or at least tied for first place in the AFC East. So it's not like the Jets' season has been a train wreck. Now, the offense has been hasn't been particularly impressive, and Aaron Rodgers has looked every bit of, you know, 40, soon to be 41 years old. But to say that it makes sense 5 games into a 2-3 start to fire a head coach, I think it's illogical, to be perfectly honest with you. And I know Aaron Rodgers came out this week and said, you know, it's patently false to think that he had anything to do with the firing. Well, I think that's, look, I think that's a bunch of BS. If you are naive, if you don't think that Aaron Rodgers was involved in this decision, that doesn't mean that Aaron Rodgers went to Woody Johnson and said, hey, we got to make a coaching change. What that does mean, and I think if you apply common sense to this, you will see that Aaron Rodgers did not give any kind of full endorsement to Robert Saleh, to the owner. The owner came out and admitted that on Monday night he spoke to Aaron Rodgers. Tuesday morning, the owner fired Robert Saleh. So what do you think that conversation was about? Was it about Aaron Rodgers' ankle? I'm sure they talked about his health. But there's no way that Robert Saleh's name did not come up in that conversation. And you're complicit if you're Aaron Rodgers, if the owner expresses some kind of doubt about the head coach and you don't stand up for him. Because if you're not standing up for him, you effectively did get him fired. You may have not expressively said, hey, I want this guy out. But if you're not pushing back and saying, hey, you know, we should keep him, I believe in him, then yeah, you're part of the problem. I've seen this before. I've seen it before in this organization. Actually, not long ago, when the general manager, Mike Maccagnan, was fired about 4 months after he hired Adam Gase. Adam Gase came out subsequently and said that he did not tell Christopher Johnson, Woody Johnson's brother, who was in charge at the time, to fire the GM, but he also didn't stand up for the GM, the man who hired him months earlier after he had just gotten fired from the Dolphins. So there's two ways to look at it. And, you know, Aaron Rodgers, yeah, he's an interesting guy, you know, and I know this from speaking to people who have worked with him and played with him in Green Bay. He's a lot to handle, and I think that his exceptional play has, you know, allowed him to get away with certain things in his career. It just got to a point where Green Bay just didn't want to do it anymore, and the Jets were so desperate that they handed everything over to him. But if you believe that Aaron Rodgers actually wanted Robert Saleh to remain the head coach, but he wasn't because he was blindsided by this firing from the owner, I've got some swampland in Florida to sell you, because that is a bunch of BS. That does not pass the smell test at all. Again, I'm not saying he was proactive in getting him fired, but by him not supporting the head coach to the owner, in which he had every opportunity to do, he in fact was involved in this guy's ouster. And I think it's frankly ridiculous, because Robert Saleh, you know, record-wise, not good. And again, he would have been justified to parting ways with him in the offseason. But five games into a season, his first season with Aaron Rodgers, when the offense is terrible and Robert Saleh's expertise is the defense, I want to know why Nathaniel Hackett's still, still on the coaching staff. That to me is ridiculous. How is he not with Robert Saleh right now, you know, going on vacation? And I think we know the answer to that. He's Aaron Rodgers' friend. So this just reeks of a desperate organization, a desperate owner, handing everything over to somebody who they believe is a savior, who's not going to be a savior. Aaron Rodgers is going to be 41 years old in a couple months. He has looked every bit that age in the first couple weeks. It'll be a minor miracle if he can remain healthy the entire season. I just think it reeks of desperation. It's what a dysfunctional organization does. Dysfunctional organizations do dysfunctional things, like fire their head coach 5 games into a season. There's a lot of culprits. There's a lot of people who are in the background who are trying to steer clear of it because they don't want the bullseye and the spotlight on them. I'm speaking specifically about the general manager, who has been more of a failure than Robert Saleh was from a record standpoint. But ultimately, this shouldn't be that big of a surprise. There's a reason why the Jets have the longest playoff drought in North American sports at 14 years. There's a reason why they have losing season after losing season. It starts at the very top, and the very top are the Johnson brothers, Woody Johnson and Christopher Johnson.
I love it. I'm here for the Manish smack talk of the New York Jets. Every week, just give it to me. That's the greatest thing. And it, actually, interesting, while you were talking about that, I was thinking that actually there was a report. I don't know if you saw it, Manish, where the Saleh actually had a sit down. I think it was with Nathaniel Hackett and like the offensive like staff, and said that he was going to be pulling play calling duties from Hackett. And then it was like literally an hour later that Saleh was escorted out of the building with security.
Right. Now, like, that's absolutely true. So I'm very curious whether the interim head coach, Jeff Ulbrich, is going to continue or go through with that, follow through with that, and make Todd Downing, who's their quarterback's coach, the offense coordinator. Downing has previous play calling experience in Oakland and in Tennessee under Mike Vrabel, actually, or whether he's going to stick with Hackett. Because if he sticks with Hackett, then you know who's running the show. I mean, you already know who's running the show. It's Aaron Rodgers. You know, honestly, look, I'm not a Jet fan. I don't have a stake in the game. And Jet fans, I know there's a segment of the fan base that can see right through this. You know, they know that Rodgers is pulling the strings. But there's also a segment of the fan base that's just as desperate as the owner that wants to believe that Aaron Rodgers didn't have anything to do with it and wants to believe that this was not the quarterback's decision or the general manager didn't have anything to do with it. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. Clearly, Woody Johnson consulted the GM. He consulted Aaron Rodgers. Neither one of them stood up for Robert Saleh enough to warrant the owner keeping the head coach. So, in effect, those two guys, the GM and Rodgers, are complicit in this as well. I just think that when you are this desperate as an organization, and there are cracks in that organization, it's pretty obvious that there are cracks based on that power dynamics where an old quarterback who has done nothing for your franchise. I mean, what has Aaron Rodgers done for the Jets other than say he doesn't want distractions while basically being the center of those distractions, whether it's in things he says on the Pat McAfee show, whether it's skipping mandatory minicamp, and Jets apologists or Aaron Rodgers apologists, I should say, will say, well, that's only one day of practice or 2 days of practice. Why does it matter? The point is, he's supposed to be a leader, Rodgers is. If you're missing mandatory minicamp, it's not about missing one practice. Obviously, missing one practice isn't that big of a deal. It's about having a separate set of rules for one guy versus everybody else. Everybody else can show up. You know, there's Breece Hall could have said, hey, why do I care if I miss one practice? Garrett Wilson could have said, I'm not going to mandatory minicamp. It's only one practice. Who cares? But the point is, you have to set a culture and an environment where the rules are actually followed. And this quarterback is doing whatever he wants, whatever he wants. He's been empowered by the owner. He's been empowered by a desperate, losing, dysfunctional organization to do what he wants. That's why he's not on the Packers. The Packers had enough. Their GM had enough. LaFleur, their head coach, had enough. At some point, you're just not worth, you know, the headache. And can Aaron Rodgers still throw the ball? Yeah, he can. Is he still as smart as any quarterback in the NFL? Absolutely. But will his body allow him to do what he has been doing for the majority of his career? And I think the answer is clearly no. Just watch the games. You know he's not the same player that he used to be. He wasn't the same player in his final season in Green Bay 2 years ago before he tore his Achilles. So I just think, you know, I find it to be very interesting that there's a segment of the fan base that is so starved to win that they are blinding themselves and deluding themselves into thinking that this old quarterback is going to take them to the promised land. The Jets are not winning the Super Bowl. You know, you can mark that down. That's not happening.
Yes.
Are they going to make the playoffs? I don't know. I mean, they have a pretty good defense. They're not as good as they think they are. There's not... and they've got some good offensive pieces. And this is what I'll say, and then I'll end the Jets tirade here. If you ask Jet fans, you would think that they have Barry Sanders at running back, that they have Jerry Rice at quarterback, that they have Alan Faneca at guard instead of an average guard in Elijah Vera Tucker, who's missed almost as many games as he's played in his four-year career. They are so starved to elevate these players. Now, what I will say is they do have good pieces. Garrett Wilson's a good player. Is he a top five receiver like some Jets fans think? No. Breece Hall is a solid running back. I could pick out 15 guys like Breece Hall. Now, Breece Hall is not the best running back in the NFL. He's not a top five running back in the NFL. I think this year clearly shows the guy's averaging 3.0 yards a carry, and there's a segment of the fan base that wants Braylon Allen, a third, fourth round rookie, to get more snaps. There's just a lot of hype around this team. There's always been a lot of hype. Sauce Gardner, to me, is an exceptional player. Is he anywhere close to what Patrick Surtain is? No, I've never thought that since Sauce came in the league. But I think Sauce is a difference-making player. I think he's a great player. He's just not the best. And if you ask the Jet fans, they think they have the best at almost every position. And to that, I would contend, well, then why can't you win more than seven games a season? I mean, if these guys are so great, why can't you win? Don't tell me it's because of Zach Wilson, because the Jets have scored the same amount of points through five games with Aaron Rodgers this year than they did with Zach Wilson last year. That to me is a cop out. There's a delusional group of people that are actually praising a general manager who is 22-50 in five seasons. If you include the 79 season of the team that he inherited, he was hired after the draft, then he's 29-59. I mean, the guy's record is laughably bad. Yet somehow, because the Jets had three first round picks and Breece Hall, who was in the top five of the second round in one draft, suddenly they've got this great team. They've got this great general manager. They had one season where they drafted a few good players. Most of the free agent signings have been busts, but they do have good pieces in place on defense. They're just not as good as they think they are. And I think that's really the story of this group of Jets, this regime. They're not as good as they talk. They're not as good as they think about. And unfortunately, I think for the organization long term, the owner has bought into it. I've been told from people who have worked with Woody Johnson, not only with the Jets, but overseas in England, this is how you get Woody Johnson to side with you. Make sure you're the last guy to talk to him. I've heard this from at least three different people in very high positions. Make sure you're the last person to talk to him, because you can sway his opinion toward your line of thinking if you're the last guy to talk to him, and make things very simple. Because if you complicate things, he will not absorb them. And that's almost a direct quote from somebody who has worked with him very closely, both in and out of football.
Well, damn. That is just put a bow on it. That is my favorite segment, I think, of all time on this podcast here. Manish dropping the mic, just love shitting it all over the Jets. That is, you know what? Screw the Patriots. I'm just here for the Jets bashing at this point. So, but without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to take a quick break just to hear from our sponsors. We will be right back. All right, we are back in action here on Between the Tackles. We're dumping all over the Patriots. We're dumping all over the Jets. It's just the AFC least is what we're going to be calling ourselves at this point with this division and how things are shaking out with everything at this point. But really quickly, guys, I want to get us into some Week 6 action. And to continue the dump fest, Burgess, I'm going to throw the microphone to you, and I want you to tell me about Drake May getting his first start for the New England Patriots against the Houston Texans. Is this something that is going to spark the change that the Patriots need? Are they going to pull the upset? Are they at least going to cover the spread? I need to know for my picks at this point. So tell me some good news.
Well, they're not going to, I don't think they're going to cover the spread. I think it's still going to be the Texans are going to have their way. I'm a pro Texans guy. So, part of me is hoping for that because the team has Super Bowl hopes. But Drake May coming in, I don't know, we've been saying on this podcast since the beginning that we did not want to see him play at all this year in meaningful snaps. What did it take? What are we, week six? Five games, and we're going to see Drake May. And I think part of it is because of how inept the offense has looked with Jacoby Brissett. I think that the team thought that they would look better than they did, through the first five games. I just hope the guy doesn't get hurt. And I know he's going to get in there. He's going to take his licks, get ready to go. Maybe they can jumpstart something. This isn't for this year. And they say that this gives them the best chance to win now, and it probably does, given how bad they've looked through the first five games. But, I'm interested to see how it goes. I am just I'm very nervous that we're going to end up in another situation where they're going to just ruin a quarterback. Saw some people talking on Twitter about it, and I know that's not the best place to go to for all this discourse and everything like that. But, if they screw this up, they're going to be right in the ballpark with where the Jets are, where, the Panthers are, where they're just cycling quarterbacks and they're breaking quarterbacks and they're just going to keep cycling and cycling and cycling. I don't want to be that. I want this to work. If you can't tell me that this was their plan going into the season, week six, we're going to put them in against the Texans. That's the plan. We're doing it no matter what. Like, that's the way it's going to be. No, I think the way that the offense has looked through five games has accelerated their plan. And the fact that it has accelerated their plan gives me a pause. But here's my all-time hedge. I'm going to wait and see how it plays out before I'm going to be like coming out here and being like, screw you, Patriots, for ruining Drake May, or you should have been playing him from week one. Not going to be like that. I got to hedge it because I want this to work. I want this to work so badly. I want to be so badly watching playoff football in January again up here in New England. So I really want this to work and really be a positive step for his development, as opposed to him coming in and all of a sudden just getting hit all the time. And he always got happy feet, and now he's got, you know, confidence issues, kind of similar to what happened to Mac Jones. So that's where I sit on it.
I think the big thing that a lot of people forget too is that the way that this season has gone so far for the Patriots, you can look at it very similarly to when the Miami Dolphins drafted Tua and they actually had Ryan Fitzpatrick on the roster. They started with Tua. He didn't do exceptionally well through, I think it was like the first like three or four games. He ended up getting benched for Fitzpatrick. Fitzpatrick came in and had some wild moments where he led him to victory. And then they kind of went back and forth where they put Tua back in, they put Ryan Fitzpatrick back in. And I think that the Patriots have an opportunity to do something similar in this situation where Drake May does not have to be the savior of this franchise right now, because I think objective football fans like us at this point realize that this is not a season where, like you said, there's not going to be meaningful football games in January because they're not going to be playing in like past January. They can use this as an experience, as a learning year. Manish, you've touched on this before where you want that invaluable experience as a rookie to get in there, take your lumps, and obviously learn what it's like going against pro NFL defenses and reading schemes and whatnot. And I think Drake May has a great chance to do this at this point where, like you said, Burge, this wasn't the plan. This clearly could not have been the plan the way that this went, but it obviously got accelerated due to the ineptitude of the offense to this point. But again, if Drake May goes out there and gets his bell rung or looks terrible or is just throwing 17 picks in a game or something crazy, they have Jacoby Brissett to put into the game to take that, you know, pressure off of him and, you know, just go in there and run the ball, do what you need to do. Use Jacoby sparingly where you need him. And then at the same time, they also have another rookie on the roster, Joe Milton, who realistically should not see the field. But if worse comes to worse, if Jacoby gets banged up and Drake's not getting it done too, Milton is available as well as that emergency third quarterback. So they have a couple of options there. It's just going to be fascinating to see how this all rolls out going forward, where if they go on some kind of run here or the offense looks a lot better than it has been, it's just going to be the crystal ball is murky as hell at this point. You don't know what's going to happen with the Patriots going forward, and it'll just be a fascinating thing to see. Before we get into the next game here, Manish, do you have any thoughts, I guess, specifically on the Drake May situation where he's coming in against the Houston Texans like this? Would it have made more sense to see him start against a team like a Miami or someone else that has a little bit little less pedigree at this point?
Yeah, I thought it made perfect sense, honestly, to start last week. The Texans, you know, you can run on them. So I think that it'll be, much of the same in that respect. You're going to see a lot of Stevenson if he's healthy. I know he's dealing with a foot injury right now. And Gibson, they're not going to ask Drake May to throw it 45 times a game unless they're, you know, down by three touchdowns or four touchdowns early, which I guess that's possible against the Texans. But the Texans do have a pretty solid pass defense. So I don't know what you're going to see out of May, other than a lot more athleticism than you saw out of Jacoby. No, we talked earlier about Jacoby getting, you know, knocked around a lot this season. I don't think that you're going to see May knocked around as much, only because I think he can elude some of that pressure. It'll mitigate some of the shortcomings that the offensive line has. So that's a check mark. That's something that actually could work. I don't know how they're going to scheme it up for him, but I would tend to think a lot of design rollouts would help him. Anytime you have a young quarterback behind a, you know, questionable offensive line, moving the pocket by design really helps out. I've seen that work to a lot of teams' advantage when you have young quarterbacks. I think you're going to see a lot of good from Drake May. I'm not saying he's going to light it up like Jaden Daniels, but and I'm not saying he's not going to get his fair share of licks, and that's certainly all going to happen. But I think you're going to see enough promise from him that, let's say they lose by, you know, a touchdown to the Texans or more. But Drake May makes five or six really promising plays that you can take away as a fan and say, hey, you know what? We might have something with this guy. We gotta build with him. Yeah, we lost, you know, and we're not going anywhere from a playoff perspective. But if he shows you enough flashes within the course of each game, I think that will not only be encouraging for the fan base, but the organization can say, hey, you know what? We might have something. Let's build on this for his second start, third start, fourth start, you know. Hopefully for him, if he stays healthy, he's got a dozen starts to get valuable experience so he can hit the ground running in 2025 so that maybe the Patriots can be a realistic playoff contender next season. But I just think if you see glimmers of hope within the course of Sunday's game, whether you win or lose, as a fan, you're going to be encouraged. You're going to be happy that they made this change. Now, if he's completely miserable like Bryce Young was last year and how Young was early this season, that's a different story. But I don't anticipate that from May. And I know preseason doesn't really matter, but he showed some pretty encouraging signs, I thought, in the preseason. So that's why I want to see him in a four-quarter game against real competition, against blitzes, unorthodox looks. And again, if you can come away with five plays, five really good plays, whether it's decision making or something that shows off his athleticism, then I think you're off on the right track with him. And yeah, it's a low bar. I mean, I know the Patriots are used to much, much bigger things, much better things. But if you're being realistic about it, if you can come away with a handful of really good plays from this rookie quarterback, sure, winning would be great. And maybe he makes 10 great plays. But just look at what Denver's doing. Bo Nix started off slowly. Their defense kind of carried them. And, now they're 3-2. And who knows if they're a viable contender. But I don't think a lot of people would anticipate it. Bo Nix playing the way that he has over the first five games. So, yeah, Sunday could be a little bit rough. But I would anticipate a month from now that things are looking much brighter for him. Again, I don't think he's going to set the world on fire, but I think if you can take away a tangible amount of good plays each and every week, that's going to benefit everybody, organization and fan base.
Well, you're saying five plays that we need to take for positives. Five plays at this point would be five more plays than Jacoby's given us all season. So I agree with you there. So, but let's move on, guys. Let's talk a little bit about some week six football. And before we get into our picks and everything like that, I'm going to throw a little curveball at the two of you, and I'm going to pick a few games that I want you guys to tell me about going into this week six action. So Burgess, first and foremost, I'm going to throw it to you. Putting you on the spot here, this game potentially has to be one of the games of the week here. The Washington Commanders taking on the Baltimore Ravens. Did anybody ever have this as potential game of the week going into week six of this season? I don't think so. But tell me about this game. Tell me who's going to come out the winner and why.
I love what Jaden Daniels is doing in Washington. Okay. I drafted him in fantasy. I got him late because I never draft my quarterbacks early in fantasy, and I loved where he was being drafted at. One of my buddies helped me out with that as well. 4-1 Commanders. They've probably been one of the biggest surprises, I'd say, of this NFL season through the quarter poll. I love what they're doing. And this was almost one of my picks for our fun segment we got going on here. I have the Commanders winning this game. I think they're going to keep rolling. I think that, they've got something going there. I know the Ravens have turned it around a little bit with their running game, but they've also at times this season kind of looked a little shaky. So, and this may be a little biased because I hate the Baltimore Ravens, from our rivalry days with them, with the Patriots. So there's a little bit of fandom coming in here, but last year, my teams were the Texans and the Lions, because they were kind of came out of nowhere and took the league by surprise. I love the underdog. I love the surprises, especially when my team sucks. So you might be hearing this is a pro Commanders podcast by the halfway point if they continue doing what they're doing there with Jaden Daniels. So ooh, give me the Commanders. That's who I'm going with.
All right. Well, I know Manish won't appreciate that, being a fan of the Eagles down there. So I don't think he's going to be voting for this to be a Commanders pro podcast at this point. But Manish, you're not off the hook either. I'm throwing a surprise game at you. I want you to tell me who is going to win between the Detroit Lions and the Dallas Cowboys this upcoming week.
That's one of my picks. That's my lock of the week. You walked right into it. I mean, the Lions are going to win this game. They're going to win by double digits. They're on the road. Cowboys actually haven't played particularly well at home, dating back to last season. The Lions coming off a bye week. Good luck, Dallas. I don't think Dallas is going to be able to stop the run. This is going to be a monster running effort, combo deal with David Montgomery and Jahmyr Gibbs. Wouldn't even be surprised if he took another deep shot, Goff to Jameson Williams for a long touchdown. But I can't see. I mean, Dallas needed every second to beat the Steelers the other night. I don't think they look particularly good. I don't take that much stock in holding Pittsburgh to so few points because I'm not a big believer in Justin Fields. But the Lions coming off a bye, weather's not a factor. It's essentially a dome game, even though it's not really a dome game. I think, you know, they're a 3-point favorite. I think they're going to win by double digits. I don't think it's going to be close.
I got to just say real quick, we got to have Manisha's lock of the week, the hashtag hitchhike pick of the week. That's what it's going to be right there.
Look, I did that one time and I won. So I'm gonna be like Costanza. I'm leaving on a high note, you know?
You're going to retire it before you screw up the magic.
It's like Costanza. You leave on a high note, you walk away. That's it.
That's right.
I'm done. No more hitchhikes. But yeah, no, I do think the Lions are going to control this game. I'd be surprised if Dallas I'd be shocked if Dallas won, but if it's close, that would still surprise me. I don't see that happening.
All right, well, I'm going to throw the microphone to myself at this point, and I'm going to give myself a game that I want to take a look at really quickly. And we seem to be having a trend with Thursday Night Football where they're actually turning out to be pretty good games the last couple of weeks. And I'm looking at this Thursday night game with the San Francisco 49ers taking on the Seattle Seahawks. And honestly, I sat there and right off the bat, I'm thinking in my head, no way San Francisco can drop another one, right? Hold that thought. I actually think the Seahawks might be able to pull this one off because honestly, Seattle hasn't looked phenomenal where they got their butts kicked by the Giants. Well, I wouldn't say they got their butts kicked, but they had a bad loss to the Giants last week where they had a chance to tie the game up at the end there. The Giants blocked the field goal, returned it for a touchdown, and the Seahawks dropped two in a row from the Detroit game to the Giants game. The 49ers do not look like themselves at this point to this season. They are just, they're 2-3. They had a really bad loss to the Rams a few weeks ago, which I predicted on that one, which it came down to the wire. They were up 21, I think, to 7 or 24-7, whatever it was. They ended up losing. They were blowing the doors off the Cardinals as well, and the Cardinals came back and beat them 24-23 last week. And, you know, a big part of that was obviously them losing their kicker, Moody, where they couldn't really go for field goals and whatnot as easily towards the end there. But to blow those games the way that the 49ers are at this point, I got to give the Seahawks a little more credit where I think the Seahawks have the personnel to take down this 49ers team. I was listening to one of our affiliate programs on here with the Gold Standard. Those guys, just all 49ers, everything. And they were talking about how they're really frustrated right now because the 49ers just paid all of their super echelon guys across the board. And it's kind of depleted the rest of the roster where they don't have guys to take over for the injured guys that are just dropping right now. You had Debo Samuel out for a little while. Brandon Ayuk got paid and has not lived up to his contract at this point. And Brock Purdy's doing everything he can to win these games. And they're just still falling apart at the end. So I actually like Seattle to pull off a Thursday night victory, especially being at home. San Francisco's favored by 3.5, which I find very interesting, where they're not giving Seattle a lot of credit here. I'm on the other shoe, though. I'm giving Seattle the credit. So there you have it for some of the games from Week 6 that you guys got to look forward to. Without further ado, we're going to get into the fun segment. Not so much fun for me this week because I did not have myself a good week last time. Yeah, 0-3. Yeah, I know. Well, you would know all about
that. Welcome to the club, baby.
Yeah, you started that trend. We got to get Manish to go 0-3 so that way he can join the club with us as well. But as of right now, what we're going to do is I'm going to run over the picks from last week and how we ended up doing. So, Manish, you took the Vikings -2.5 versus the Jets. That worked out very well for you. You took the Patriots -1 versus the Dolphins. That did not work out for you.
I was peer pressured by myself. You can't have a Patriots podcast without somebody taking a Patriot game.
You can blame Burgess for it. I'm okay with that. That's completely fine with me.
I'm holding a grudge too.
He's here now, so it's just treat him like you do the Jets. Just go after him, and I'm okay with that. So, and then for your third pick, Manish, you took the Packers -3 versus the Rams. That obviously worked out very well for you. So overall, Manish, your record is at 5-4, and congratulations, you de facto are now the leader on the board here. Which again, we will update our graphics after the podcast. Manish will get the little crowns next to him. Unfortunately for yours truly here, I'm joining the basement dweller, Burgess, the former basement dweller. Now we're sharing the basement together. I went the dreaded 0-3 last week, where I took the Colts +2.5 versus the Jags. Ended up being a hell of a game. The Colts did everything they could. The corpse of Joe Flacco going out there slinging the rock around. They took it to overtime where Jacksonville unfortunately got the upper hand there, and the Jaguars pulled off their first victory of the year. I took the Bengals +2.5 versus the Ravens. Bengals were up by 10 late in the game. I'm sitting there going, this is great. Jacksonville's going to blow it. The Ravens are going to blow it. Lo and behold, Bengals stutter, puke all over themselves in overtime. They lose by 3. aka I lose by three. So 0-3, where I finished at the bottom there with the Saints plus 5.5 versus the Chiefs. Saints just did me dirty. I thought the Chiefs were going to be banged up. They didn't even need help from the refs this week. The Saints just puked all over themselves, and that's how the story goes. So I'm 0-3. That brings my overall record to 4-5 at this point. And then Burgess, who was not here but got his picks in for us, he took the Bucks plus 2.5 versus the Falcons. How'd you feel about that pick when you went to bed on Thursday night, Burgess? Tell us a little bit about
great.
That.
Felt great. Bucks up at halftime. Woke up at 5 a.m. and I see they lose in overtime. I'm like, oh, that's a great start to my Friday right there. 0-1.
Well, if it makes you feel better, that was your only loss for your picks this week, because the next pick you had was the Cowboys plus 2.5 versus Steelers. It took 20 seconds left in the game at about 1 o'clock in the morning on Monday, where the Cowboys pulled it out just barely. They knocked off the Steelers there for your upset. And then you took the Commanders minus 3.5 versus the Browns. I don't even think the Browns were within 30 points of the Commanders in that game. So that brings your overall record to 4-5 along with me as well. So without further ado, guys, before we wrap up this podcast, you got to give me your picks for this week. And since he is the new leader on the leaderboard, I'm going to throw the microphone to Manish. Manish, give me your three picks for this weekend.
Okay, well, you guys already know the lock, the Lions minus 3 at Dallas. I explained all the reasons why. I'm going back to the Packers well one more time. They are 5.5 point home favorites against the Cardinals. And, you know, as you touched on, Hogan, if not for Jake Moody getting hurt, I don't think the Cardinals would have beaten the Niners last week. Going on the road for a second consecutive week, I'm a big Jordan Love guy. Like, you know, he's now, what, 2-3 weeks now removed from his MCL rehab. He's just getting better. He didn't play particularly well against the Rams. Did it just enough. He got it to his tight end a couple times. But, you know, I think the Packers win this one comfortably in Lambeau. And I'm going to Tampa. Well, I guess I'm going with Tampa to New Orleans, because the Saints are going to be without Derek Carr. They got Spencer Rattler making his first career start, rookie, against the Todd Bowles defense. You know, good luck with that. The Bucks are giving 3.5. I'll easily and happily take the 3.5. Give away the 3.5, I should say. So I'll take the Bucks minus 3.5 at the Saints. I think they win that game. I think it's another big game for Baker Mayfield, who's been on a season-long heater. I don't see him slowing down. He had that one hiccup in Denver. Other than that, he has been absolutely on fire. So I'll go Bucks favorites, Packers favorites, and the Lions road favorites against the Cowboys.
All right, there you have it. So the leader has spoken. He has given us his lock of the week and his wins that he is projecting. Let's go to number two, Burgess. What do we got for your picks this week?
All right, I'm going to start off. I'm going with the Bengals minus 3.5 at the Giants. I know the Giants are coming off a big win against Seattle last week, but I still don't really have a whole lot of faith in them. And despite the Bengals' performance through 5 weeks, I still I'm a little bit of a believer in them there. So this is more of a pick against the Giants, because I don't think they can string it two in a row. And I think the Bengals maybe get right on in the night game on Sunday. So Bengals minus 3.5. Next pick, you'll like this one, Hogan. I hate the Titans too. I'm going with the Colts plus 2.5. I know Michael Pittman is going to be out for a few weeks. I just have no faith in the Tennessee Titans to continue to, you know, to put anything together. Will Levis is a clown to me. Give me the corpse of Joe Flacco if Anthony Richardson can't go again. And, you know, Joe Flacco, again, I hated him when he was a Raven, but in his late stages here, like seeing what he's doing when he gets on the field as a 40-year-old quarterback is unbelievable considering where he was. So Colts plus 2.5 at the Titans. And then for my third pick, I am going to be the one to pick against the Panthers here. I've picked against the Falcons quite a bit this year so far. Kirk Cousins had more passing yards than the entire Patriots team had all season the other night. So I'm going to take them as heavy favorites in Carolina. They're Falcons minus 6. So those are my three picks.
That's actually a stat. We buried the lead. That's like the most amazing stat, that Cousins had more passing yards in one night than the Patriots have had all season.
Yes.
It doesn't take much at this point, clearly, with the ineptitude of the Patriots. And speaking of ineptitude, we are going to go to yours truly to give my three picks. Hopefully, where I will not go 0-3 again. But I'm taking a little bit of a chance here. I'm picking some crazy games here. So I'm going to be the guy this week to pick against the New England Patriots. I find it where even with Drake May starting, I cannot see the Houston Texans coming to Foxborough and dropping. I'm taking Houston -7. The biggest thing that obviously scares me about this game is Nico Collins heading to IR, which is obviously he's been destroying the league with his receiving up to this point. I think he was miles ahead of everybody else that was even within sniffing distance of him, and him going down with a hamstring injury is really going to hurt with CJ Stroud getting the ball to some of his big playmakers there. But again, you take away Nico Collins, you got Tank Dell, you got Stephon Diggs, Joe Mixon possibly coming back from injury, all those things together, still one of those players alone is better than pretty much half the Patriots offense, the way I look at it. So give me the Texans -7 at New England, spoiling the debut of Drake May. So we got that one. And then for my second pick, I'm actually going to go on a limb. I'm going to go with the Broncos. The Broncos +3 versus the LA Chargers. I know the Chargers are coming off a bye week. They're a little dinged up themselves. I know Justin Herbert was, you know, hobbled by his ankle injury a little bit there. But I think Bo Nix and that Denver defense is just, they got something rolling. Even though he's fighting Sean Payton on the sidelines, screaming at him and just telling him to get out of his face, Bo Nix, like you said, Manish, earlier, he started off slow and he didn't look particularly well, but him just making the plays that he does, running the ball and getting the ball to the guys that he needs to. And then that defense, Patrick Surtain is absolutely got to be the best corner in the league right now. And then that 100-yard pick six he had last week against the Raiders was just unbelievable. I mean, they made the Raiders bench both their quarterbacks essentially by the end of that game. They were both so putrid. Give me the Broncos +3 versus the Chargers. And then for my last one, that makes zero sense whatsoever. I don't care. I'm taking it anyway. Give me the New York Jets +2.5 versus the Buffalo Bills. And obviously, we touched on how much the Jets are just inept and that the Bills shouldn't even have Josh Allen at this point. But give me a head coachless interim job freaking coach at the New York Jets and give me the Rodgers train to actually get going against the Bills, because for whatever reason we talked about a little bit beforehand, I think the Jets just happen to be Josh Allen's kryptonite. I mean, yes, he has beaten the New York Jets from time to time, but even last year where Rodgers went down four plays into the season, Zach Wilson still led the charge and knocked off the Bills in week one. For whatever reason, it makes no sense whatsoever. The Jets are just going to win this game. That's just the way I'm looking at it. It's at New York. I think that's going to help a lot, where the fans are going to get rough and rowdy and possibly a little inebriated. And you know what? They're just going to cheer that team right on. I certainly won't be cheering the Jets on, but at this point I have to, because I got to take them to win something.
I'll be cheering them.
So hopefully I will not go 0-3. That's right. We'll see. There you go. You don't want me to go 0-3. You want me to go at least 1-2.
1-3. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what we got this week, guys, for our picks, and we touched on everything that is newsworthy. I think that's going to put a nice little bow on this episode, unless either one of you, Manish, you got another tangent in you. I'm ready to listen for 20 more minutes about how the Jets suck, so you can give me another one.
There's plenty left in the tank, so we've got like 12 more weeks to go.
I love it. I love it. Burgess. Yeah, that's right. That's right. We got plenty of time to keep spewing the hatred here. Burgess, you got anything for me before we sign off?
It's just going to be so Patriots this year for them to win a game when you pick against them. So
that probably will happen.
I'm rooting for that.
Well,
give me a reason to root for Drake May and the Patriots this week. Give me a reason.
I mean, I'll root for them. I don't think I see them winning. That's my big thing. But without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, as always, thank you for joining us for another week of Between the Tackles. Both of you, love hanging out with you. Love talking football. We'll see you both next week. So, as always, go Patriots, and we'll see you next time.
Peace!
Later.